Hello, this is Melissa, and I am joined today by Jared, and we're going to do an installment of the Tragedy and Hope Book Club. And before we launch in and I talk to Jared, I just wanted to mention the May reading assignment, and that is going to be two chapters, and the first is Finance, Commercial Policy and Business Activity, 1897 to 1947, that's Chapter 7, and International Socialism and the Soviet Challenge, and that is Chapter 8. So that'll take us the whole month of May. Now, Jared is very involved in the book club. He is a regular at the chat room and has made a lot of good contributions. I don't get to spend as much time there as I would like to because every single time I go over there, one thing that I noticed a week before last was there was some, one of the members of book club is Hayes Review. I think his first name is Nick, but Hayes Review reviews books in a series of streaming videos, and I've been able to catch about one and a half of those, and the last book that he did was on the Rockefeller Foundation, and the author, I don't remember the first name, it might have been Robert, but the last name was Fosdick, and it's very interesting what he's doing, but I hadn't paid any attention to the Rockefeller Foundation. And that was a great rabbit hole to go down and see who is the current president of the foundation and what he's up to. So I just want to thank you off the bat, Jared, for being such an integral part of book club and the conversations that are going on. And so finally, with no further ado, hello.
Howdy. Thank you for the recognition. Yeah, we spent a lot of time in there talking about a lot of different stuff. And it's good for people like Nick and I because we're allowed to have some kind of camaraderie because we weren't quite too aware, I guess, some of us, before the big 2020 event. And now we have this book club where we can commiserate and go over all the books that Alan recommended.
That's great. That's great. Well, I think you're getting up to speed pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's. I've been taking in a lot really quickly, and I'm not sure if I've been digesting it as much as I should. But I mean, while I'm at work, I can listen to the book Tragedy and Hope, and then also I switch back and forth between Alan's recordings and the book club. There's so much information in the world. It's really hard to navigate. And I feel like having like signposts and beacons like these books and the books that we're going to be covering and that Alan mentioned so many times, just this one book alone, I feel like this was the best one to start with.
It's daunting at first. But I think if we keep reminding ourselves that retaining a string of dates and events and battles is not the most important part of the exercise, it really is more to get the big picture and even, as Alan might say, read between the lines. And there's a lot of richness there if you don't get bogged down in the details.
Yeah, and I also wanted to start even just a caveat just for this chapter alone in this discussion. Quigley himself even mentioned that whole volumes have been written on the lead up to this one war itself.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the Buffer Fringe, where you know it, even where they were like expanding out, and it talks, it's basically setting up for everything in this chapter.
Yes, I also wanted to say, too, before we dive in, that today we're just going to be recording World War I, 1914 to 1918, that chapter. And then Jared and I are going to record either tomorrow night or the next day the Versailles Treaty. And that will go up at the end of the week. Hopefully this one will go up in a day or two as soon as we can get it done and I can make a little video out of it. So we're just doing the one chapter, and that's plenty. But you made a really good point there about all of the lead up. One thing, I did not make a page note there, but at the beginning of this chapter, Carol Quigley talks about two important things, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente. And he said, towards the beginning of the chapter, that the lead up to the beginning of World War I was a series of uninterrupted crises. And he outlines a few of them. And I think that that is worth noting, that there were, that between like 1898 to the beginning of World War I, it was just one crisis after another.
Yeah. And there was like such a big transition just, I think, over the 18th to 19th century, mm-hmm. or the 19th to 20th. One of the first things I had noticed right off the bat, which is, it's always funny how casually he'll mention things like this, but he's talking about the influence that strengthened the Triple Entente, and it was that of an international banking fraternity. These were largely excluded from the German economic development, but had growing links with France and Russia. Prosperous enterprises like the Suez Canal Company, the Rothschild Copper Enterprise, Rio Tinto in Spain, and many newer activities in Morocco created numerous unobtrusive links which both preceded and strengthened the Triple Entente. And it said, he says, the Rothschilds, close friends of Edward VII and France, linked to the French investment bank, Banque de Paris et de Pays Bas. I don't know how to speak French, but he's always mentioning the Rothschilds in like these giant banking fraternities so casually. Like they're not really a part of it, but he has to mention them.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's funny.
And then the other thing that really stuck out to me was how he talked about that the Germans were basically left unchecked for about 10 generations, for like 250 to 300 years. And it was kind of weird that he mentioned that too, because he speaks about them in generations, like it's like this really broad perspective of time.
In this chapter too, he seems, what he's talking about in Germany is that broad perspective of generations, and then the fact that they were mostly left alone because they were doing the good thing, which was concentrating on their own internal organization. In other words, uniting as Germany, making a united Germany. And so that seemed to be, for the big picture of what they wanted with Europe, that was a good thing. They weren't over, Germans weren't conquering the world or doing empire, so they got to be left alone, you know. Then they became a good enemy, finally.
Yeah, it's also a weird thing of what England kind of did, was they would always like let their second biggest rival like grow, or they would basically let a rival to their second biggest rival grow, and mm-hmm. that would keep the proximity power in check to them. And it's like he mentions their strategy right in the book. That it says right here, tended to welcome the rise of Germany because it relieved her to a great extent from the pressure of France in the political and colonial fields. And it seemed like basically that it was just, this was like, to me, like a very dramatic end to the colonizing of the world at broad.
That's a good point.
Yeah, because they had the bases. They were, Europe was colonizing, and basically the First World was colonizing the rest of the world everywhere that they could, basically, it seemed like. And they were all the way over to China, Africa, South America, all the small islands they were trying to claim and take over. So there's a lot happening in that century. So you were talking about basically what led up to what was leading up to it, and he has several dates listed out here.
Mm-hmm.
And the first Moroccan crisis and the, I can't read that, the Algeciras conference.
Algeciras or Algeciras, and I did not take the time to look that up, so I don't know other than what he wrote what that is about, but that's 1905-1906.
Yep. And it went all the way to 1914. Let's see. There's Agadir in the second Moroccan crisis, the Tripolitan War, the first Balkan War, the second Balkan War, the Albanian crisis, the Lehman von Sanders affair, and
Sarajevo.
Yeah.
What is interesting there and what you just rattled off, Jared, is that all of this led up to the whole series of wars, which David that outlined that Croatian war so excellently in the episode from last month. We don't get too much about that history. You know, it's just something that Clinton did, and we don't really have a, I mean, I thought David's outlining of it was one of the better explanations that I had the benefit of receiving. But you can see that everything building up to the crumbling of Yugoslavia, Serbia, Croatia, all of this was set up all the way back there, 1908, 1914.
And isn't that the area where like Bolshevism started, or where the communists were trying to get their finger and take over? I just thought that was where they were trying to like take over as well, like in the next section of the book. But
what you had here in all of those regions at that time was Russia's involvement, you know, before there was a communist revolution, before there was a Soviet Union. You've got Russia heavily involved in that region of the world.
There was another little section I wanted to read about, just how they were, how everyone felt leading up to it. Yeah, I just have some highlights in the book, so
okay.
That's basically all I have. So the atmosphere leading up to the war must have been pretty tough for people, and he wrote a little section on it here, and he says, I'm at 221 now. He said, the atmosphere of nervous exhaustion after 10 years of crisis, the physical exhaustion from sleepless nights, the alternating moves of patriotic pride and cold fear, the underlying feeling of horror that the 19th century optimism and progress were leading to such a disaster, the brief moments of impatient rage at the enemy for starting the whole thing, the nervous determination to avoid war if possible but not be caught off guard when it came, and if possible to catch your opponent off guard. Instead, and finally, the deep conviction that the whole experience was only a nightmare and that the last moment some power would stop it. These were the sentiments which surged to and fro in the minds of millions of Europeans in those five long weeks of mounting tension. Also, there was an assassination to the heir of the Habsburg throne on June 28th, 1914, which to me, I think that's kind of crazy, because a lot of people think that secret societies and these like assassins guilds were just like a thing of bygone, but I mean, when people get assassinated, it seems obvious to me that there's still people that do that to create conflict and strife, and it just seems like a red herring to me.
It's interesting, too, because I don't think at any time in history assassinations would be easy to carry off for, you know, the lone gunman. And they are excellent ways, just like sinking a ship or, you know, bombing Pearl Harbor or whatever. I mean, they're excellent, excellent ways to kick off a war, assassinations are. So I never buy the disaffected, you know, lone nutter.
I don't know. It takes so much coordination and resources, and that's a pretty big target. The heir to the throne is mm-hmm. like that would be mainstream news for forever if it happened these days. That's, say the president's, one of the president's children were killed or something.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I'm on page 225 here, and he has a pretty interesting comment to say here, and that's the military history. And he says, for the general student of history, the military history of the First World War is not merely the narration of advancing armies, the struggles of men, their deaths, triumphs, or defeats. Rather, it presents an extraordinary discrepancy between the facts of modern warfare and the ideas on military tactics, which dominated the minds of men, especially the minds of military men. This discrepancy existed for many years before the war and began to disappear only in the course of 1918. As a result of its existence, the first 3 years of the war witnessed the largest military casualties in human history. These occurred as a result of the efforts of military men to do things which were quite impossible to do. And it just made me think about how he was describing all of the old tactics, basically, from the previous century, where they would just line up in lines and shoot mm-hmm. cannons at each other and charge. And basically, all of the, it sounded like the way he described it, all of the generals and commanders had this same kind of ideal where, I think it was called the doctrine of continuous front, mm-hmm. where they would basically just charge in there with their bayonets and try to create a hole in the line and then rush in with cavalry and try to take out like the back flanks. And they spent most of their time training people with bayonets. And he specifically mentions how most of the generals and commanders weren't really incorporating the barbed wire, the trenches, and the machine guns. And the machine guns, I think, were kind of new back then. And that was another thing that was also really surprising, how much new technology was introduced. And it was like they were industrializing warfare, testing out like industrialized warfare tactics with, you had tanks and planes and submarines and different kinds of gas. And submarines weren't ever used, I guess, in naval warfare, according to him. I know they were used in previous wars, but probably just a few times, not really strategically. But it was really, I think it was the submarines which really caused the war to end. Because that's when America got into the war, after, I think, the Lusitania was sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty crazy what led up to that.
What you're talking about, working on new kinds of weaponry and testing out new kinds of weaponry, we just mentioned this briefly when we talked the other day, was the war of attrition. How many foot soldiers they were willing to lose so that they could keep an encounter going in trench warfare, or they could experiment with their new weaponry. Gallipoli is an excellent example of that. And I'm just going to read in this. This is a little bit of a side here, but Gallipoli, or the Battle of Gallipoli, was a military campaign in the First World War on the Gallipoli Peninsula. And that was a year, almost a full year, 19 February 1915 to 9 January 1916. The Entente powers, Britain, France, and the Russian Empire, sought to weaken the Ottoman Empire, one of the central powers, by taking control of the Ottoman Straits. If you've never seen the movie Gallipoli, I think it's an excellent overview of what military officers and the higher-ups are, how much they're willing to sacrifice.
Yeah, it's insane. I was actually wondering what movie I could have read to get kind of a cinematic download to get a different perspective. I didn't get to, but I found my other page over here too. I missed one of my pages of notes, but the other thing that really astounded me was how fast they could move, how many men they moved on trains, and how quickly they moved their men around just for a tiny strip of 5 or 10 acre straight or something like that. It was pretty, it's just, to me, it blows my mind. But one of the battles that really stuck out to me was when the French moved 3.7 million men in 7,000 trains in 16 days from August 2nd to through the 18th, and they opened their attack on Lorraine August 14th, and by the 20th, they were shattered. By August 25th, 11 days of combat had suffered 300,000 casualties. This was almost 25% of the number of men engaged, represented the most rapid wastage of the war. And I was trying to look that up, Google search it, Wikipedia, and I don't think it even said, it wasn't even in there. So that was surprising. And I did the math on that. On average, that's 1,100 men an hour.
What was this, the battle called?
I think it's the French were attacking southern Germany because he says right here.
What page is it?
228 at the bottom, the second to last and last paragraph. And it said they just wanted to drive into southern Germany, whose Catholic and separatist peoples were not expected to rally with much enthusiasm to the Protestant centralist cause of the Prussianized German Empire. While this was taking place, a force of 800,000 Russians were to invade East Prussia, and 1,500 British were to bolster the French left wing near Belgium. Russians and the British with the French were trying to invade southern Germany, I think.
So I'm just looking at that right now, 3,781,000 men in 7,000 trains in 16 days, opening their attack on Lorraine on August the 14th. By August 20th, they were shattered. By August 25th, after 11 days of combat, they had suffered 300,000 casualties. How many per hour was that?
1,136, I believe, an hour. Just like, I just wanted to find out, like, what, you know, just average. Obviously, they weren't fighting 24/7, but if you just do the math on that, that's what, I mean, that was one of the things that I wanted to do, was just get some statistics put up. And I still don't know how many people, men's lives were eliminated total. It seems to me like it was like another way to cull the populations down of Germany, or not Germany, Europe, and to amalgamate and centralize the whole continent of Europe, because after this, they created the League of Nations, and they created a lot of other international councils and boards and round tables and chambers and commissions. They just created a lot of centralizing organizations that came out of this war just to try and make peace, I guess, or treaties, I guess, is what it really was about on paper, on its face.
You bring up some really good points there, and remember that Alan would always point out that H.G. Wells bemoaning the fact that not enough lives were lost for their big plan of depopulation, that they would have to have another war. But so there was so much loss of life in World War One. Another thing that Alan has talked about are what they call cenotaphs. You have a slightly different way of having a monument or a memorial in the U.S., but across Europe and in Great Britain, you have these cenotaphs. Often they look a little bit like an obelisk, but you've got names of the lost for an area cover this cenotaph. And he said, from his travels in Europe, that he would go into a village and you could see, he could tell by just reading the names on there, whole families of men were wiped out. And so besides everything that this did for furthering depopulation and European amalgamation, it also ushered in things such as nihilism, erosion of faith, erosion of commitment to the traditional religions that you had always had, chiefly Christianity. It was very, very dark. And another thing, too, I've looked at some interesting documentaries about Great Britain in particular gearing up for World War II, and a lot of family farms were still struggling to recover from the fact that they had no men there to farm the land because of World War I. You know, there's not that much time that elapsed between the end of World War I in 1918 and the beginning of World War II in 1939. That's 21 years, and you can't recover from that loss of life.
No, I never heard of those monument memorials. I don't remember ever hearing about those, but speaking on like the Christian aspect, mm-hmm. One thing that he mentioned, which I thought was, I mean, I guess it's appropriate for him, but he didn't mention how they had in the first year the ceasefires for Christmas, and how a lot of the troops had a ceasefire on Christmas Eve and Christmas, and that didn't last throughout the whole war, but a lot of companies and enemies were able to do that, and they were even like, I guess some of them were trading souvenirs and
chocolates,
food,
yeah,
and singing and all that. And there's not one single, he doesn't mention anything like that in the book. The only way he spoke about something positive was if Great Britain, or I mean England, were to win a battle, or how they were pushing, anytime they pushed back the Germans, or anytime the Britain got their treaties twisted and let the merchant ships attack the Germans, or the civilians attack the Germans. That was the only time he talked about something positive in there, was when someone was doing something underhanded and against the laws.
Well, speaking of movie depictions, there is a fictionalized account based on a lot of real-life events called Joyeux de Noël, and that shows that beautifully. It's a touching film about the ceasefires that happened on Christmas Eve, and it's something that when we're thinking about how we are used, how our peoples are used historically to fight these wars that we never are told the real reason for, is that when you put your supposed enemy in front of you and you can see them as a human instead of demonized like the evil barbaric Hun, the monsters that the propaganda portrays them as, you understand as a human that you're looking at another human. And that was something, we can touch on that a little bit later, but one of the things that Quigley did touch on just a little bit here in this section was the use of propaganda.
Yep. I was already thinking that. But the other thing I wanted to say that I picked up on was that he actually mentioned entire nations and states were wiped out and destroyed in there. So that you mentioned entire families and lines of men, but it was even worse. It was whole states and nations were swallowed up in this war. And it's hard to believe because just being young and not knowing much about history, it's hard to imagine, let's say, America getting broken off into different pieces, or part of a European country, or part of Mexico disappearing and changing, or something. The map changing is something I'm not aware of that's happened in my lifetime. I'm not saying it hasn't, but just to think that, I don't know how many, but it's something that I'd never really thought about before, was that whole entire places just get completely destroyed, like a whole town or a village gone forever. History gone forever.
It's very tragic. And this is something, you know, he calls his book Tragedy and Hope, but the tragedy of it, well, he doesn't write in an emotional way. You know, he writes as a historian. So I guess we are left to flesh out the tragedy for ourselves.
Right. I guess that's something I never really considered with the book, because I always figured it was a weird name, too, because it's not just like a history of this year to this year or whatever, but I'm sure he had a good name for it. On page 235, he starts talking about the submarine and how it was a new method of warfare. Mm-hmm. And it was applied with hesitation and ineffectiveness until 1917. And then it was applied with such ruthless efficiency that almost 1 million tons of shipping were sunk in the month of April 1917. Britain was driven within 3 weeks of exhaustion of her food supply. And basically, it just outraged them, and that's what brought the United States into the war. And that doesn't seem, it seems like they were maybe, I don't know if they were getting ahead at that point, and they actually upset the bankers and the merchants, because that's what I thought when I heard that, was when that happened, they probably pissed somebody off with doing that much damage and destroying that much property and almost wiping out the food supply of Britain. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting approach to this as an excuse for getting the United States into it, but we know that the intent to bring the United States into this preceded that those heavy losses and the loss of the food supply and so forth. You know what I mean? I mean, to me, it strikes me as more of just an excuse that he grabbed as a historian and an author, rather than really having the depth of the truth behind it.
Well, that's where the propaganda comes in. And I remember him saying that before that, the people weren't, and this is what he said verbatim, immunized to propaganda yet.
Yes.
So when World War II came around, people were more weary, but in World War I, it was mainly about morale, is what he mentioned so many times about the morale. And just doing that Google search on the Christmas treaties, the fighting, or I mean the treaties and the peace and the ceasefires waned out. And it's because the enemies started hating each other more and more and more. And mm-hmm. I think that was when the propaganda was taking effect and really sinking into the minds of the people, not to mention how many people were dying. But he definitely mentioned propaganda and international law were aimed at the Germans when they retaliated against civilian attacks.
Well, and the way he puts it here with the submarine attacks, he said, this danger of a British defeat dressed in the propaganda clothing of moral outrage at the iniquity of submarine attacks brought the United States into the war on the side of the Entente in that critical month of April 1917. In the meantime, the German policy of military attrition on the Western Front worked well until 1918. There's two things here, because a lot of people are more visual than reading a book. Some people are just listening to audio versions but still following along in the club. And I think that there are two movie recommendations that will help you have a better understanding of this. All Quiet on the Western Front is an excellent movie. There may be a couple of versions of one I'm thinking of. It's probably from the 70s. And another one is satirical called Oh, What a Lovely War. And it's particularly with the satire of Oh, What a Lovely War, the war of attrition, the fact that we are just, I think they were called Smiths on a blackboard. So the dead troops were Smiths with the numbers just being chalked up of loss of life. So those will add something to the understanding. But it is interesting the way he says it. So Quigley's not bothering to tell us all of the behind-the-scenes things that were going on to actually bring the U.S. into the war, but just the fact that finally the unfairness of submarine attacks and the way that they were able to capitalize on that propaganda, then people said, oh, okay, well, that's just not right. That's not a fair fight.
Yeah, that just, it chaps me, it just chapped me so bad to hear that, because the whole time he just kept saying how the British were breaking the, what they thought were the international laws of war, and then they do that, and all of a sudden, then they brought America in. But what I felt was kind of interesting too, how he was saying that basically nobody could really stay out of the war, that there wasn't really any neutrals. It was hard to get diplomacy figured out because so many people were sending supplies to and fro. So you couldn't really be considered a neutral because of that. It was just weird because he was basically saying everybody was involved in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Like the Netherlands, they were basically, they were neutral, but the British had the English Channel blockaded, and this is where that happened. Yeah, it says right here that the United States continued to insist that the Germans obey the old laws while condoning British violations of the same laws to the extent that the distinction between war vessels and merchant ships were blurred. Accordingly, German submarines began to sink British merchant ships with little to no warning. Their attempts to justify this failure to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants on the ground that British floating mines, the British food blockade, and the British instructions to merchant ships to attack submarines made no such distinction, were no more successful than their efforts to show that they were their severity against the civilian population of Belgium was justified by the civilian attacks on German troops. They were trying to carry on a legal distinction remaining from an earlier period when conditions were entirely different and their ultimate abandonment of these distinctions found that their enemies had already abandoned them merely made matters worse, because if neutrals became belligerents and non-combatants became combatants, Germany and her allies would suffer much more than Britain and her friends. In the final analysis, this is why the distinctions were destroyed, but beneath all the legal questions was to be found the ominous fact that war, by becoming total, had made both neutrality and negotiated peace almost impossible. We shall now, okay, now he's talking about how they started negotiating peace, but it was like, he was saying that there was, because this was a world war and it was modern war, that before wars were just limited goals with like limited amounts of resources available. But now with the propaganda and everything, it was total war with unlimited objectives and unlimited resources. And he kept saying that, I don't know if it was in the end of this chapter or the beginning of the next one, but that the capitalists basically miscalculated because they thought the war would be over in 6 months because of the lack of funding. But all the countries just liquidated their assets and their golds and changed their currencies over to fiat currencies and different types of currencies just to fund the war.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I think it was towards the end of this chapter that he gets into going off the gold standard and the just basically printing currency to fund the war. That's a very good point there. I mean, as I was pondering that, I was thinking about Alan just talking about how the whole, anything can be made to be, to have a value. You know, you could trade seashells and certain shells could become the most valuable commodity. But we have it drilled into our heads with the money con that gold is real and other currencies are fiat. And there, you certainly, because of the way they were playing the game, and we touched on this in the recording that we did about money when Darren and I spoke, that there was just the idea that we have this idea in our head that you've got international bankers and it's the international bankers controlling everything against the little people, but there are, Quigley talks about that in the section on money. He spent quite a lot of time on it because he said this is very important, that the bankers don't always agree. Are we going to keep inflation down or are we going to be inflationary? And I think that's important to remember, that there have always been in controlling this con some who would keep us back to gold and do things a certain way, and others who don't have that approach. Yeah, it all heads us to the same direction, ultimately.
Yeah, it seems like it's moving in one direction for sure. That was, I don't remember which page that was.
I think I wrote down on my notes it was 257, at least what I was thinking about in taking, creating money. Let's see here, where does it go?
I was on 39, what I just said about the ships and all that. But,
right. Well, we can just keep going in sequence if you like.
Well, I mean, I definitely wanted to mention this because earlier you mentioned the Ottoman Empire, and he says he's talking about the disposition of the Ottoman Empire was the famous Balfour Declaration of 1917. Probably no document of the wartime period except Wilson's 14 points has given rise to more disputes than this brief statement of less than 11 lines. Much of the controversy arises from the belief that it promised something to somebody and that this promise was in conflict with other promises, notably with the McMahon pledge to the Sharif Hussein The Balfour Declaration took the form of a letter from British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour to Lord Rothschild, one of the leading figures in the British Zionist movement. This movement, which was much stronger in Austria and Germany than in Britain, had aspirations for creating in Palestine, or perhaps elsewhere, some territory to which refugees from anti-Semitic persecution or other Jews could go to find a, quote, national home. Balfour's letter said, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a natural home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. And then he goes on to say, It is to be noted that this was neither an agreement nor a promise, but merely a unilateral declaration that it did not promise a Jewish state in Palestine or even Palestine as a home for the Jews, but merely proposed such a home in Palestine and that it reserved certain rights for existing groups in the area. Hussein was so distressed when he heard of it that he asked for an explanation. And it was assured by D.G. Hogarth on behalf of the British government that, quote, Jewish settlement in Palestine would only be allowed insofar as would be consistent with the political and economic freedom of the Arab population.
Well, we have to look and to see who D.G. Hogarth was, because he may have been a man of his word, but that word was not kept.
Yeah, unfortunately, what reading that just makes me think of what's going on right now. And it kind of makes me think about things in a larger perspective. And I don't know if this is true or how I heard it once, but I feel like that each century has its own like kind of theme, but it basically only lasts like as long as a human will live. So I don't know, maybe if you're lucky 100 years. So I think we're still pretty young in this century because we're only in 2024. So it just kind of makes me think in a bigger perspective about what things can be done. But another thing I was thinking was how the old saying goes, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it, or history rhymes. And it's something that I try to keep in mind with what happens in the beginning of the last century and what's happening now.
Yes.
I don't know if it can be correlated or not, but it seems maybe, I don't know.
Well, I think so. I think that things don't necessarily repeat, but you see similar approach over and over and the similar strategy being used. Doing that real history with Henrique and finding out what I didn't know, which was the parallels between the contested election, the protest / storming of a capital, the arrests, the really lengthy prison sentence for some. And that happened in January of 2023. So 2 years after we see this operation / event in the U.S., we see it in Brazil. And I think when we look, if you know enough about history, again, big picture, you definitely see parallels between what's been done before and what is done now. Because if they can do it at any point in history, they can do it again whenever it suits them.
Yeah. I have another weird note that I found, and it was where he was trying to explain what got the United States in. I know we've already talked about it, but he gives like 4 reasons, and it's pretty funny.
Oh, you're that's so funny because I wrote that down. It's on page 249.
Yep.
Yeah, I noted that as well. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he said these might be summarized as follows. One, the German submarine attacks on neutral shipping that made it necessary for the United States to go to war to secure freedom of seas. Two, the United States was influenced by subtle British propaganda conducted in drawing rooms, universities, and the press of the eastern parts of the country, where Anglophilism was rampant amongst the more influential social groups. Number four, and this was my favorite because I don't know.
Don't skip number three.
I won't. The United States was enveloped into
inveigled. Sorry.
I looked that word up too because I. Anyways, they were basically suckered in, like if
yep.
they worked, it's like, well, I think of like a fishing lure and you're fishing something
mm-hmm.
you know, into war by a conspiracy. Let me start over. The United States was in, I'm going to mess up that word again.
Inveigled,
there we go. Into war by a conspiracy of international bankers and munitions manufacturers eager to profit or to protect their loans to the Entente powers or their wartime profits from sales to these powers. And number four, balance of power principles made it impossible for the United States to allow Great Britain to be defeated by Germany. Whatever weighed of these four in the final decision, it is quite clear that neither the government nor the people of the United States were prepared to accept a defeat of the Entente at the hands of the Central Powers. Indeed, in spite of the government's efforts to act with certain semblance of neutrality, it was clear in 1914 that this view of the chief leaders in the government, with the single exception of State William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State. Yeah. So he's basically was saying it was impossible for the United States to stay out of the war, and he mentions Canada down here as British territory adjacent to the United States and exposed to invasion from land of the United States constituted a hostage for British naval behavior acceptable to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was weird that he mentioned that because, you know, the United States was enemies with Great Britain at one point, but then you have that colony right above them. So he's just basically saying that was like a bargaining chip. Sounds
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I couldn't not. I kept looking for the him to mention the bankers and the Rothschilds, and he does a few times, and it's pretty interesting. The next page is 256. Do you have anything in between there?
Well, the one thing that I noted was on page 251, and this was on about propaganda. I'm just gonna see here.
The propaganda.
Yeah, he says the Times of London announced that 4/5 of her passengers. Oh, I missed the Lusitania. The event was the Lusitania and the propaganda that was around that. So the Times of London announced that 4/5 of her passengers were citizens of the United States. The actual proportion was 15.6%.
Could you read that again? You're kind of cutting out.
The Times of London announced that the Lusitania contained that 4/5 of her passengers were citizens of the United States. Now, it appears that it wasn't quite that many, but that was, you know, whipping the U.S. up. The British manufactured and distributed a medal which they pretended had been awarded to the submarine crew by the German government. In other words, they just made something up. So the British made a medal. They manufactured it. And then they said that the Germans had made that medal and awarded it to the submarine crew by the German government for sinking the Lusitania.
Yeah.
So there was no trick too dirty to be tried. Then it said a French paper published a picture of the crowds in Berlin at the outbreak of war in 1914 and said it was a picture of Germans rejoicing at the news of the sinking of the Lusitania. So that just struck me as, you know, nothing too dirty when it comes to propaganda and whipping up public emotion and sentiment in favor of going to war.
Yeah, and even that pisses me off just hearing that, because I know they've done that too in modern times. They'll put something on the TV that's from not even anything that's even a anything bad or a war. They can just take a clip from something that happened and then say it was something else, and people will believe it and it'll go viral.
Yes.
The other crazy thing too was he mentioned that there was a mysterious second explosion and that 128 of 197 Americans lost their lives. So it was like, sounded like a setup, because they didn't have their lifeboats lowered. They basically, this mysterious second explosion happened. It doesn't sound like a coincidence to me.
No, I agree.
Yeah, it's just so weird how he just puts stuff in there like that.
All right,
I
don't have anything before 256, which is where you said you were going next. So.
Okay. Yeah, basically he was just talking about the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace said the war destroyed over $400 million of property, when at the time the value of every object in France and Belgium was not over $75 million. I think that's right. Hundreds, millions, I don't know, maybe it's $400 billion, but I think with the B, yeah. When I was listening to it, he said million, and I'm like, oh, I don't think that sounds right, but yep, 400 billion with the B. When they destroyed that much, when France and Belgium didn't even have that much, and they were worth less than that.
Well, that is interesting.
Yeah. Oh, here was the quote that Alan always famously paraphrased, and I have it highlighted over here, but he says, the war brought nothing really new into the world. Rather, it sped up the process of change, which had been going on for a considerable period and would have continued anyway, with the result that changes which would have taken place over a period of 30 or even 50 years in peacetime were brought about in 5 years during the war. Mm-hmm. Also, the changes were much greater in objective facts and in the organization of society than they were in men's ideas of the facts or organization. It was as if the changes were too rapid for men's minds to accept them, or what is more likely, that men, seeing a great changes which were occurring on all sides, recognized them, but assumed that they were merely temporary wartime aberrations, and that when peace came, they would pass away and everyone could go back to the slow, pleasant world of 1913.
Wow, that is such an important passage that you just read. That people assumed that it was a wartime aberration. Because, Jared, don't you think that this is exactly what we've lived through in the last 4 years?
Yeah, it is absolutely. The technology has been here, and they've had it. I mean, Lord knows they've had this and much more advanced stuff, but with the push and the forcefulness of it, and then the declaration of an emergency is a legal statement, and that's something I remembered Alan would always say too, when the politician, the president, prime minister, any of these people get on stage in front of their little pulpit on the TV and they read you something, it's a legal declaration. And if people don't en masse respond in the only way that they can en masse respond with their civil disobedience and show of basically force, peaceful force, but you know, you have to act with one mind, then it's gonna stay and it's gonna go into effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I remember that definitely when Trump came out in 2020, March 13th. It's like branded in my brain, where he said he's unleashing the full power of the federal government. And I remember talking to an older fellow in 2020 and realizing that we were being rationed, because that's what happened during this war too.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned something like this was like a war, and the guy was an older fellow, and I think he said it was worse than World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of was pretty deep thing to say casually to some stranger.
Well, I mean, it's true. It's true. And that he recognized that is, you know, it's a good thing, but that's exactly where we are. And so many people now, they're back watching their sporting events, and, you know, it's life as usual. I know, you know, I talk to people who say that they see differences in people, and that I've even had somebody say that people smile less and have less spontaneous interaction, let's say, out in public with a stranger at the grocery store, that kind of thing. There may be some differences, but for the most part, people have decided that it's business as usual, that it may have really hurt the economy, but we're battling back. And the sense that I have is that the world is completely different than it was 5 years ago. Totally.
I agree. It feels the same to me. It feels like night and day, and people just aren't as jovial. And I think you mentioned nihilism, or how it brought in nihilism. And I know he's mentioned it more than once about how people thought that things were going to go back to what they were in the late 18th century, mm-hmm. or the late 19th, and that they just thought that it
yes.
was just going to go back, and it was temporary. And he's mentioned that more than once. And that's why that stuck out to me, because I guess people are stuck in their ways, but they gotta move the people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have any more notes till the end of the chapter.
I mean, I had two really minor things, and the gold standard was one of them. So we've already touched on that. And I think the other note that I made was also about propaganda, which was page 263. And it's just, I don't even know. It's just he's talking about, oh, sorry, that's okay. It's just the way in which the Germans and the Russians were portrayed. In general, manufacture of outright lies by propaganda agencies was infrequent, and the desired picture of the enemy was built up by a process of selection and distortion of evidence. Now, come on, what is distortion of evidence if it's not an outright lie, right? But by propaganda agencies was infrequent, and the desired picture of the enemy was built up by a process of selection and distortion of evidence, until by 1918, many of the West regarded the Germans as bloodthirsty and sadistic militarists, while the Germans regarded the Russians as subhuman monsters. A great deal was made, especially by the British, of atrocity propaganda. Stories of German mutilation of bodies, violation of women, cutting off of children's hands, desecration of churches and shrines, and crucifixions of Belgians were widely believed in the West by 1916. So there's more on that, and I think it's a page worth rereading for people who have already read it or considering. But this demonization of the enemies has always gone on, and we see this right now with Ukraine versus Russia and Israel versus Iran and all of her proxies. It's just, it's a formula.
Yeah, I was looking right at it, so I didn't mean to interrupt you. But he gives several different reasons why they needed atrocity stories. He says to build up the fighting spirit of the mass army, to stiffen civilian morale, to encourage enlistments, especially in England, where volunteers were used for 1.5 years, to decrease subscriptions for war bonds, to justify one's own breaches of international law or the customs of to destroy the chances of negotiating peace, to justify severe final peace, and to win the support of neutrals. On the whole, the relative innocence and credulity of the average person who is not yet immunized to propaganda assaults through the mediums of mass communication in 1914 made use of such stories relatively effective. But the discovery in the period after 1919 that they had been hoaxed gave rise to a skepticism towards all government communications, which was especially noticeable in the Second World War. So I hope people are listening to that out there. Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a good broad strokes view of the chapter. And if there's nothing else, then we're going to record the Versailles System and the Return to Normalcy, 1919 to 1929, in a couple of days and get that up this week too.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I'm not used to it, but
you did great.
Yeah, it's just been a while. I always get a little nervous when I first start recording, and then I hopefully catch my groove. But it's not my first time stuttering and stammering. And I don't know all these big words. I mean, geez, it's like if you want to go to sleep, just listen to this book. The only way I can get. Because I'm working during the day. I can't sleep.
Truthfully, Jared, I mean, I can't even count how many times this book, since we started on Book Club, has put me to sleep at night. You know, it's just when I think, oh, I can't go to sleep, there's too much on my mind or whatever, I just pick up Tragedy and Hope. It's like a sleeping pill.
Yeah.
But to reiterate, for May, the assignment is to read up to and including these two chapters. So these two chapters. Finance, Commercial Policy, and Business Activity from 1897 to 1947. That's chapter 7. And International Socialism and the Soviet Challenge, which is chapter 8. So that'll take us through the entire month of May. And I thank everybody who is participating in the book club. I am learning a lot, not just about Quigley and Tragedy and Hope, but about a whole myriad of things which get discussed in the chat room. And I'm finding it quite interesting. So I thank you all who are participating and reading along, and Jared for doing this with me.
Yeah, thanks everybody. And we look forward to seeing you in the Telegram group and hearing from more people that want to participate in this, the discussion.